or House State Affairs. That's the way the day's going. To order, it's Tuesday, April 5th. And President Representative Elkin, Representative Gardner, Representative Lynn, myself, Chair Seaton. And today we have SB 104 first, and then we will go to a presentation by the Public Pension Board, or Pension Division, on healthcare for 238 and other related bills. And so we have with us today our Senator Seekins to present SB 104 to us. Is there any questions or anything else for the committee before we start?
Mr. Chairman, it's Elkins.
Did I say Elkin again?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I thought I had that down.
You're offbeat today. There's no doubt.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I got this respiratory cold back again. Welcome, Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I appreciate being able to be here this morning to present to you Senate Bill 104. This is a bill that seeks to strengthen the Department of Revenue's ability to investigate fraud that's associated with making false applications for permanent fund dividends. The submission of a fraudulent permanent fund dividend application under this bill would become a Class C felony. In 2004, the Department of Revenue examined over 1,600 fraud tips, audited over 1,700 permanent fund dividend applications suspected of being fraudulent. This resulted in $1.4 million in denied or assessed dividends. Furthermore, there were three federal indictments and one conviction for crimes involving PFD fraud. Currently, under state law, we can't prosecute for fraud, but the federal government can. The most common PFD fraud offenses involves persons who forge the signature of another on the application or on related documents with the intent of receiving a dividend to which they are not entitled. It's important to note that the bill is not intended to capture, for example, cases where husbands or wives sign for each other. However, the provisions of this legislation would apply in cases where the individual is attempting to steal from another person or from the state. Current law describes three separate degrees of forgery. The two most serious offenses are punishable as Class B and C felonies, but these are limited to cases involving various types of financial instruments, such as currency, security, deeds of trust, and etc. Forgery in the third degree covers instances where a person intentionally makes a false statement on a written instrument, such as a PFD application. However, this offense is punishable as a Class A misdemeanor only under current law. The Department of Revenue's proposal is to elevate PFD fraud from a simple misdemeanor to a Class C felony, and is expected to provide a more effective deterrent for this type of theft. Furthermore, Senate Bill 104 aids in identifying and curing instances of permanent fund dividend fraud by codifying in statute a fraud investigation unit within the Department of Revenue. This will assist the Department of Law in detecting and the Department of Revenue in detecting and investigating instances of PFD fraud. For an example, we anticipate that by having this unit in statute, they will be able to access the national crime computer system to be able to find people that may be trying to hide and because they are stealing from the people of the state of Alaska. I introduce this bill, ladies and gentlemen, because we all probably, as Alaskans, know of people who are trying to tap into the permanent fund who don't deserve to do so and are not qualified to do so. This makes this a very serious crime now to steal from the people of the state of Alaska, and I would appreciate your support on the bill. And we have some people here from the Revenue Department to answer questions if you'd like.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Lynn.
Did I understand, Senator, that without this investigative unit in place here that we can't access the national folks?
We could now. We believe that this should bring it to that point. We can apply to do so. Our current fraud unit, which we have, doesn't have the necessary statutory authority to be able to allow them to do so. this would allow them to do that.
And so, if I may, so they've just permitted us to do it, but they didn't have to. Is that it?
Well, they would have to go through the Department of Law, through another agency, to be able to do so. This would allow them now to do so directly.
Thank you.
Right.
Does anyone else have questions for the sponsor? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. The House just passed House Bill 127, which allowed Peace Corps volunteers to receive pro rata dividend. And one of the provisions of that reduced the fine from $5,000 to $3,000 for fraudulently claiming a PFD. And I don't remember exactly how that went, but I think it had to do with our ability to actually collect on that. And it looks like your bill addresses that in a much more severe way, a stronger way.
It is, through the chair, it is a stronger way. I applaud any effort to collect, but in this case, these folks are now, it's not a collection issue, it's a felony. And we move it up from a misdemeanor to a felony, a much more serious charge.
And Representative Gardner, I believe that the relationship between the $5,000 fine sent it into another category of requiring a public defender and those kind of situations, whereas if it was a $3,000 fine, it could be instituted without the state, as a fine without the state having to provide a public defender. So the idea of lowering that fine was not to lessen the impact, but to actually make it so that it was worth enforcing, because if we had to provide a public defender to someone, and you were only going to collect $5,000 fine, it's losing money for the state.
So it made collection efforts more cost effective.
That's correct, and made prosecution under that much more likely, because then you could go after you could assess the fine without having to get into providing public defender services.
Mm-hmm. And if
I
could,
didn't mean to distract, but
no.
Since the two came up, I thought we'd better clarify.
I would say that, Mr. Chairman, that this is intended to go after the most serious offenders, which right now we as a state don't have the teeth to be able to do that. And this will be a major deterrent. Someone will think twice, and the department would say on the application it's going to very clearly state that intentionally trying to defraud the state, that you will be charged with a felony. Mm-hmm. A felony conviction has a whole lot more ramifications than a misdemeanor conviction.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I was wondering, what kind of fraud is a major fraud now? I mean, when you talked, I heard you say major fraud, but what do they do to do the fraud?
Well, I can have some of the folks up here from the Permanent Fund Fraud Division, and they can give you a really good, if you'd like. Where's our fraud folks? Let me.
Thank you, Senator. Good morning. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Sharon Barton, Director of the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, and Dan Boone with me is our Chief Investigator, and he can tell you about those good stories of the really egregious fraud perpetrated in the PFD program. I thank you for considering this bill this morning and thank the sponsor for bringing it forward. The PFD program, as you can imagine, is particularly vulnerable to fraud. It's free money. We have 635,000 applications to shove through the pipe in just a few months of consideration. So it's a program that is vulnerable to fraud for sure. We started 2 years ago really beefing up our investigations of fraud, and last year you all authorized subpoena powers for the division, which has helped us substantially with our audits, particularly. This piece will really, really help us with, as the sponsor described, those egregious cases. So I'll let Dan tell you about some of those we have prosecuted this year through the federal system, and then a couple he has going right now.
Well, primarily, our...
And would you identify yourself?
Again, I'm Dan Boone, investigator with Permanent Fund, Department of Revenue. And some of the areas that... Well, I'll just set a background here. The division currently is we're really encouraging the public to file online applications. In such, we're looking at an application filed online. We're promoting electronic signature. If you've been in the system, you can do that. And then a direct deposit. So everything's done electronically. Everything's done without paper. The problem we have now is that once you're in the system, to identify you when you moved out of state, when everything's done electronically, has been very difficult. We're working on methods currently and some technology that will help us identify outside IP addresses that we can look at individuals who are outside the state of Alaska who say they're in the state when they answer the question, are you in Alaska today, and yet they have an outside IP address. We're looking at those types of technologies to help us with that. But currently, when somebody's in the program now and they're perpetrating these types of crime, it's hard to root them out unless we get a fraud tip. Sometimes it's been under the misunderstanding that, well, people move out of state and they're just going to get one last PFD. Well, our experience has been mixed. It's some people, yes, they do move out of state and they do get one less PFD. However, we're working on individuals who are going after one PFD after another, year after year after year. And some of these cases, a couple cases currently right now, we're looking at an indictment, a potential indictment. We're working with the FBI right now on a wire fraud case where an individual has falsified military documents showing that he's been in the military, but in fact he's been out of the military since 2001 and has been collecting a PFD from 2001, not only for himself but three dependents. We're working on another case right now currently with the new AG where we have an individual, again, a former military spouse. They moved out of state in 1998. He had not applied for PFD since 98, but she has been applying from 99 through currently, and basically she's been with three children. We're looking at about $30,000 of being defrauded from the state. And the caveat with this case is that she's been filing with her three children, but 2 years ago one of her minor children turned 18, and so he's been filing for 2 years, and he's never lived in Alaska. And so we're going into this, and as we're keeping very good statistics, we're finding that there's a general attitude of, once I'm outside of Alaska, nothing's going to happen to me. You guys aren't going to do anything to me. We know it, so we're going to take our shot. And the other problem that we're looking at is that, hey, it's only a Class A misdemeanor. If I collect the money, then it's a Class C felony. And so I can determine what I want to do if I get the money or not. And so we're getting an attitude that in the past, it's not been very conducive for a deterrent effect. So what we've been doing is we're beefing it up with legislation, with subpoena power, as Sharon Barton had testified earlier, to do some formalized audits, as well as look at what we're seeing out in the field. And currently, I'd say about approximately 64% of our fraud cases are dealing with individuals out of state. And so we need access. We're dealing with multiple aliases, individuals that have three and four identities. Our last conviction was an individual who had used two aliases and to double dip and collect PFD. We have an individual right now in jail who's been indicted who is an illegal alien who's been, again, assuming someone's Social Security number. And again, we're hoping to get a conviction out of him. We have a couple other cases that we're looking at the federal government. And the reason we're looking for the federal government is because our state statutes have been very weak, that there is no forgery per se for permanent fund as far as a permit fund application that puts teeth in anything. And same with criminal impersonation. When we're looking at a PFD and we're looking at criminal impersonation or we're looking at forgery, we're still looking at a Class A misdemeanors. And with the AGs and everything that they're under, it's really been difficult for them to take a Class A misdemeanor versus a felony case.
Appreciate that. A follow-up on this is we've got another bill that we're looking at presently that allows use of power of attorneys to submit the applications. How would that fall into this this falsification? And you know, one of the big questions that was brought forward on that was that you can't under a power of attorney, you can't really tell somebody's intent to return to Alaska, and therefore that basically the intent to return to Alaska provision is made void by the use of a power of attorney. Are any of these are these unsworn falsifications that we're talking about here, are they often relating to the intent to return to Alaska, or is that a totally separate issue?
It's a totally separate issue. It's the things that we do, because in the there is an intent issue that's really, and I'm not an attorney, and I know some of you are, so for me to try to explain intent would be frivolous, but we're dealing with individuals that have deliberately and recklessly disregarded material facts pertaining to their eligibility or eligibility of others that they're applying for. Children they don't have custody of, children who are deceased, anything that we know that's definite has fraud written all over it, versus an intent issue. So I would say ours, the criminal, the way we pursue our cases criminally, they're definitely more cut and dry than an intent, which is a lot of gray area in there.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gruenberg, and by the way, for the record, Representative Gruenberg joined us about 10 minutes ago.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Boone, a couple of questions. First of all, does this bill go to judiciary next?
It's just one committee.
Do you guys know? Right.
Don't recall.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask a few questions that I might otherwise reserve for judiciary. I am concerned about a possible constitutional challenge on the basis of equal protection, setting up this particular type of fraud as a felony, where other types of fraud, and I'm focusing on pages 3 and 4 of the bill, for other benefits and for other types of forms are only Class A misdemeanors. I strongly support the bill. I note that 18 of the 20 senators co-sponsored it too, and I'll probably do that. So I want to protect this against such a challenge, and that's why I'm asking you a few questions. Number one, is there specific legislative history explaining why this is a felony and other types of unsworn falsification for similar types of benefits are only Class A misdemeanors? And would you like to put on the record, I'm sorry I missed a little of this, why this is being set up as a felony as opposed to other types of unsworn falsifications?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenberg, Chris Pogue from the AG's office is here with us today, and he had done a piece for us in looking at this legislation in concept to that fact, and perhaps he could better answer that question.
Okay. Well, before you flee, don't go yet. Are you planning, if you take a look on page 4, line 5, it's conjunctive, and it says that other types of unsworn falsifications, second degree, if it says on a form bearing notice authorized by law that false statements made on it are, quote, punishable. Are you going to specifically say on all PFD documents that are sworn that this shall be punishable as unsworn falsification in the first degree? Because an argument could be made, if you don't, that it would only be misdemeanor. Are you going to specifically say that it's punishable in the first degree and that's a Class C felony?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we haven't drafted that language as yet, but we would certainly take that under advisement.
Representative Grunberg, we just were informed that this does have a judiciary referral, so I'd like to take care of most of, you know, those at judiciary, because we have the Division of Retirement Benefits that I have to leave soon.
I would just mention that.
Oh, and that's fine, Representative Grunberg. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just wanted to.
I appreciate that. That really. Question. The other things I wanted to mention briefly to think about, and the other thing I was thinking about, and are we going to hear from the AG on this?
Yes, he's.
But wait a sec. Don't go yet, because I think you might consider whether we want to have in here some findings that specifically say why we're setting this. I never recommend finding, but this might be something to consider in the bill. And the other questions go briefly, Mr. Chair, to the federal implications of this. It used to be, and I assume it's still in the case, is if somebody is in another state or flees the state and they're engaged in a felony, that you can bring the federal authorities in under what's called UFAP, unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Is that one of your intentions here, to be able to get federal assistance in the enforcement of this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, most of our cases haven't flown before they've perpetrated the crime. They've moved out of state and then perpetrate the crime. But in going after these cases, we will do whatever is appropriate on each individual case.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the sponsor? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Do you anticipate there'd be some sort of threshold as to which cases you would actually pursue? Because surely if a person commits a fraud once or even twice, it isn't necessarily worth the resources to track them down and pursue charges against them.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, our approach in general has been very conservative. We imposed fines about a year, or fines just this year, and the five-year withdrawal or forfeiture only a year ago for the first time in the program. And we proceeded very carefully with those first cases as we felt our way along as to where was it appropriate to apply those civil penalties. We consulted with our AGs, we talked over cases before we began, and now that we have are looking at a Class C felony, we will certainly consult with our good AG support before we proceed with any action. But we, and Dan can tell you more about his procedures, but he proceeds with a case to the point that he feels certain that there is some criminal element to the case, and it's at that point that he stops and consults with the AG so that procedurally we don't taint a case if we do take it forward. So we will continue to be that cautious in the future.
Okay, and I'm going to interrupt proceedings for a little bit here to find out, do the members of the committee have many more questions? If they do, we're going to have to roll this down to the calendar and get our presentation by the retirement benefits section. If we don't have many more questions, what I'd like to do is move this and sure. Let it be resolved in judiciary if they're judicial questions. Yes, Representative Lewis.
At your pleasure, I would move this bill. I would move a CS for Senate Bill 104 Judiciary, 24-LS0519/L, with individual recommendations.
And we have two attachments.
Oh, and two attachments.
Okay, thank you. And is there any objection to movement of this bill?
I'd like to just make a short comment, though, Mr. Chairman. I got to tell you, I have a firsthand knowledge of fraud. In another life, I used to buy dividends, and it was a very lucrative business to start with. But when they finally shut it down, I was lucky and got out with my shirt and my pants and a few dollars in my pocket. But I still have people in the system who have never proven to the state that they were real people. In order to do that, they had to produce a birth certificate, an original birth certificate. And when they did, and a few of them have over the years, come back to the state and applied, and I would get that dividend from way back. But it was surprising the amount of money that and the people that were involved in the fraud. So I understand the problem. It's a little bit different problem, but they're out there. I know that.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no further, no objection, it'll move from committee with attachments. We'll note in the
Chair,
thank you very much for coming. We now have a presentation by Division of Retirement and Benefits, and I believe Melanie is coming up, and you should have a copy of a
is that, what's your 238?
Actually, this is the medical portion of the plan, and we're having medical portion of this plan is quite complicated, so there's a presentation that Melanie has right now. It's being handed out, and Retirement and Benefits will lead us through that, and then we'll work on the section on retirement medical benefits. Yes.
This is the medical portion of the committee proposed plan?
That's correct. Well, what we have before us, first of all, is we're going to get a presentation of the tier task force that worked for the boards, and then we'll go into for the retirement boards developing the tier four proposal, and then we will go through the differences between that and some of the issues on the table currently.
Is that
correct, Melanie?
That's my understanding.
Okay. That's what we hope to do. So, Melanie, would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record? Yes.
I just wonder what bill.
For the record, my name is Melanie Melhorn, and I'm the director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits Department of Administration. Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to come.
Good morning. Before you start, Melanie, this will pertain to House Bill 238 and the development of the health care model.
Okay. And do we have Brad Lawson on the line from Mercer?
Yes, Brad is on the line, I believe. Brad, can you hear us?
Yes, I'm present.
Okay, thank you very much.
Wonderful. Well, I want to kind of start with the members of House State Affairs by kind of setting out a little bit of framework, a little bit of background for the presentation material itself. And we're going to, Brad Lawson and I are going to co-present this information. It was prepared by Mercer Human Resource Consulting, who is our actuarial consultant. And back to Chair Seaton's comments, this is material that was worked on very extensively with the TIER committee for a number of months, and one very key component was the medical area. And Mercer engaged in a great deal of analysis by asking Aetna, which is Aetna is our third-party administrator, to provide them with our actual claims experience. And based on that claims experience, they analyzed the cost to the system and redesigned those costs going forward with a new tier medical plan design. And in order to provide feedback about that medical plan design, there was a survey sent to all employers, and some key components came out of that survey from the employers. And what the employers said is that the medical component is a very important component of their retirement package. And so based on that, the
feedback from the employers included some key elements that I just want to run through very briefly that kind of set the stage for how the medical plan was designed. And those elements are that.
And this is slide two.
I'm just talking from presentation material on November 19, 2004 that was provided to the full board for PERS and TERS. It's found in the survey information, and the key elements that underlie the medical plan design include that the members should bear a greater share of the cost of medical benefits. Number two, that members should have to retire from the system in order to be eligible for medical benefits. Number three is that system benefits should favor longer service members. And maybe if I could just touch on that briefly. When you compare our plan right now, and I'll just talk about Tier 1, you can satisfy that criteria for medical coverage after you vest and when you are age eligible, so after 5 years of service. And if you are age 55 under Tier 1, you would be able to be provided with system-paid medical for yourself and your dependents. So that's very different from the new medical plan design, because what this plan design is going to do, and we'll get into that a little bit further, is that it recognizes the years of service for a member and provides a greater benefit based on greater years of service. So number three was that system benefits should favor longer service members. Number four was that employer contribution should be predictable and stable. Number five is that healthcare inflation risk should not be borne solely by the employers. Number six is that benefits must take the form of new tiers. And number seven is that the annual cost of benefits should not be designed to exceed current systems' normal cost rates. So those are the key elements upon which...
Would you go over that last one again?
Sure. Number seven is that the annual cost of benefits should not exceed current system's normal costs.
You're talking about normal cost of all benefits for a new tier program.
Of the medical also.
Okay. That the medical component should not exceed the current medical component or the...
Correct.
Okay. Yes, Representative Gardner.
Could I ask you to repeat the fifth one? Inflation cost should be?
Healthcare inflation risk should not be borne solely by the employers.
So in other words, the first one was that the employee should share more in the cost of the program, and that the and then number five is that the potential inflation that the employee should also share in that risk as well.
Okay. That's correct.
Thank you.
So turning to the presentation material, some of the key features of the post-retirement medical program include that members must retire directly from the system to be eligible, system-sponsored health plan with varying levels of subsidy or cost associated with members. We're going to go over that a little bit more. Early retirees get access only prior to normal retirement eligibility. And access only means that the member can apply, but they have to pay 100% of the medical premium costs in order to receive the medical coverage. So that's what denotes access only.
So if we were in the Aetna system and we had a state retirement Aetna plan, someone that's under 60 years of age could then participate in that plan, but they would have to pay the entire premium.
That is correct.
Okay, thanks.
The defined dollar benefit from normal retirement to Medicare eligibility is currently age 65. And we're going to cover all the various different components within the medical plan, because there really are essentially three, and we'll go over each of those. The defined health benefit after Medicare eligibility is similar to the current program with the following key exceptions. And there's a slide presentation in here that will really depict what we or what the medical design is right now for post 65 and what the new design would entail. So the method of coordination with Medicare has been changed under this plan design, and that retired members will share in the cost through premium contributions, and we'll go over that a little bit more, because essentially right now, under the post 65 portion of the benefit for members, there really is no cost share. So what this plan is designed to do is to inject cost share into that area when an individual is eligible for post 65 medical coverage. So turning to slide 3, this just kind of sets out under the current plan what the deductible is, what the out-of-pocket amount is, what the current prescription drug costs are to the members right now, and then the alternative plan is what would be proposed under the new medical plan design. So you can see there's quite a bit of change there. And one thing that I would like to mention is that during the TIER study and research, they benchmarked and looked at other medical plans in order to compare and contrast, and what the actuarial consultant determined, which I think there's been a lot of testimony in the legislature this session, is that our medical plan costs are one of the primary drivers for our underfunded status. But moreover, the study indicates that our medical plan benefits are very rich compared to other medical plans. And so the new plan design takes that into consideration and redesigns those costs. And just for example, some of the presentation and the research material that's available on our website, if you want to look at what other plans are offering and how we compare and contrast to those particular plans, we studied the state of Washington, Wells Fargo Bank here in Alaska, state of Oregon, state of Idaho, BP, and Alaska Federal Credit Union. So when you look at theirs, state of Oregon, their deductible is $500 as compared to the state of Alaska retiree plan right now with a deductible of $150. The cost for Alaska USA Federal Credit Union, which is an employer that obviously employees could work at here in Alaska, and their deductible is $500 as compared to the state of Alaska at $150. So those are just some comparisons that I think are important when we look at our plan design. So turning to slide number 4, the eligibility criteria would include normal retirement for medical benefits as age 60 with 10 years of service. And if you look at Tier 3, that's kind of the baseline right now for Tier 3. So it was built off of that baseline. 25 years of service for police and firefighters or teachers, and 30 years for PERS all others. Disabled participants would be eligible. And terminated participants are not eligible, and I think that that's a very important feature of this new plan design. You must retire directly from the system in order to be eligible. But just for example, some of the presentation material that House State Affairs members received before includes a listing of all of the tiers and the parties who are eligible under the public employees retirement system and the teachers retirement system. And right now, for our medical plan, we cover 54,000 members, and our claims cost for 2004 was $225 million. Now, if you just look at the parties who are eligible for our medical plan right now, and you project into the future, and you expect that all of those categories, those individuals will receive a benefit, there's approximately 90,000 members. And the dependent ratio is 1.9. So if you were to look into the future to do some projections, you would be able to see that there would be a population if there's some deferred vested members here who will receive that benefit, but there's also members who have to satisfy some more service or some additional service in order to be eligible. But you could be easily looking at a population in the future of 180,000 members.
And you said 1.9, that's 1.9 dependents per retiree, is that?
Right, it's a member plus
0.9 or plus 1.9?
Yeah, that's right. It's 1.9 approximately. So a member and the dependent ratio right now, based on the number, the configuration is 1.9. That's the number that we use.
I'm trying to figure out whether does the 1.9 include the member?
Yes.
So that it's less than one dependent per with the member.
Yes. Okay. Yes, I'm sorry. I was not clear there. So we're right now on slide number 5. And this kind of covers the three discrete areas that I talked about before for medical coverage. So that includes that early retirees would receive access only. They are not eligible to receive a subsidy from the employer. The access only means that they pay the premium amount, the full premium amount, but they still get coverage. And I think it's important to note that that is still a very, very good benefit. There's a lot of people out there who may leave employment or may have breaks in their health insurance, and in order for them to actually get access, sometimes it's very expensive, and depending on their medical conditions, it may be cost prohibitive. So I would just like to leave the members with the key point that access only, while they do have to pay the premium amount, is still a benefit. So that's kind of the primary factor there on slide number 6. And turning to the second area, this is normal retirement to Medicare eligibility. So members who satisfy the criteria and who retire directly from the system would be eligible for a defined dollar benefit. There's a fixed dollar subsidy for the health care coverage. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. There's some slide material.
You're going to talk about that later?
Uh-huh. Okay. It's in the presentation material.
And before you go any further, there's been some real question about members retiring directly from the system and some confusion as whether that means that if somebody has 30 years and they're pre-60 and they retire, is that retiring directly from the system, or do they have to wait until they're either 60 or 65 or Medicare eligible and then retire? There's been some question that people have to work for 38 or 40 years instead of for the 30 years of normal retirement. So can you define retiring directly from the system for us?
Right, and there's really two areas that you can look at going back to slide number 4. You must be age 60 and have 10 years of service, and then you are eligible for the medical benefits, or you can satisfy that criteria by years of service alone. So the 25 years of service for police and firefighters and teachers, and the 30 years of service for all others. So those are the key criteria that you must satisfy in order to be eligible for the medical benefits and the subsidy portion.
Okay, so either one of those satisfies as the criteria of retiring directly from the system?
Correct.
Thank you.
All right, and we're still on slide number 6. The subsidy amount that we'll discuss a little bit later is based on the length of service, which I touched upon earlier, but I think that that's a really key component of the new medical design, because the employers wanted to build in recognition for long service, and this medical plan does that. Also with the defined dollar benefit portion, which is the pre-65 component of the medical plan, there is a built-in 5% inflation factor associated with the subsidy amount that would be looked at on an annual basis, and the member would receive benefit of that up to 5% inflation factor. That also, it's the DB component of the defined benefit portion of this medical plan design, and it still has some volatility to the employer in the sense that that's a cost that is going to increase on an annual basis. Turning to slide number 7, this is the second component of the medical plan design, in that if you look at those segments for a member, it's pre-65 and post-65. And the post-65 portion is a defined health benefit. And that includes that the members will make a contribution based, again, on their years of service. But I think we all recognize that the cost to the system pre-65 is much higher. What the research and analysis has shown through the TIER study is that 75% of our medical costs are attributed to and can be allocated to pre-65 members, and 25% of those costs are allocated to post-65 members because there is a coordination with Medicare that occurs on the post-65 period of a member's health care coverage. And that cost is quite a bit different because Medicare is primary and the Alaska Care Plan is secondary. So the costs are reduced to 25% for that segment. Medicare eligible dependent spouse is eligible for the Medicare benefit level, and there's the way that the plan design right now, and maybe Brad can go into this a little bit further to elaborate.
Let's back up just a moment. We had 25 and 75, and I'm curious because although we have higher expenses currently or projected in the pre-65, those 5 years pre-65, mm-hmm. that's a defined dollar amount. And yet on the post-Medicare eligibility, we're talking about defined benefit amount. And though we're identifying 25%, if Medicare eligibility changes, if Medicare reimbursement rates change, we could be looking at an unfunded liability on the post-65 or post-Medicare eligibility that we don't have no control over, whereas with the defined dollar contribution on the pre-Medicare eligibility, haven't we contained that growth, especially with the 5% escalator?
Well, the premium amount, when there's not a coordination with Medicare, we bear all of those costs. So right now, when you look at the existing claims costs and you look at the premium amounts that we established for that, 75% of the costs are allocated there. There could be some changes in Medicare that would change the post-65 costs and could increase those costs to the system, depending on those changes. Medicare reform in 2006, for example. There is some pretty extensive presentation material in the November 19th material, and if the members are interested in what the Medicare costs are and what that change and impact is, I encourage you to take a look at that. I've not provided that presentation material for today's.
Right. No, hearing, I just want to, you know, one of the big criteria of the entire process is to go forward and get ourselves out of the prospect of having unfunded liabilities. And I guess, you know, we talk about a defined dollar contribution, mm-hmm. and I guess you're telling us it's really not a defined dollar contribution, it's a defined percentage of a unfixed premium, and therefore is not a defined dollar amount pre-eligibility. But my worry is also that we have actually have a, we're back to a defined benefit post 65. And I, at some point in time, we're going to need clarification between what we're calling a defined dollar amount when I'm not sure it's defined.
Mm-hmm. And this is Brad, and maybe I can address that just a little bit.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. Would you go ahead and give your full name and who you are for the record?
Hey, this is Brad Lawson. I'm with Mercer in Seattle.
Thank you. Go ahead.
And kind of just stepping back a little bit, talking about the a defined benefit, if we look at the pension side of things, there's a lot of risk and volatility associated with the defined benefit plan, primarily driven by fluctuations in interest rate, as we've experienced in the last few years. When we look at the medical side of the current benefits, we not only have that interest rate volatility and risk, but we also have a trend volatility and risk, and that's the risk that our that the medical benefits will grow at a greater or even a less rate than we've assumed in our projections. And when we talk about a defined dollar approach, that is a defined benefit component because it does have that same interest rate risk. So what we have done by having a fixed escalator of 5%, we've eliminated the what we would call the trend risk or that health inflation risk. So in one sense, we have contained that component of the risk. That health inflation risk then is being borne by the retirees versus by the system at that point. Does that help clarify a little bit?
I guess so, except I think there's still some questions among the committee and myself as well as to why we're calling it a defined dollar amount ahead of pre-65 when actually what we've got is a percentage of premium. And
I can address that as well. The defined dollar terminology comes from the fact that while we start with a premium base, that base actually does not grow as a premium would or a health cost would. It grows in a defined manner of 5% or less. And it's, you know, in our current environment, it's unlikely that health inflation will be less than the 5%. So we can actually go forward maybe 10 years and based on a member's years of service, we can have a very accurate picture or a defined amount that the system will be contributing towards their health cost. So even if health inflation was 15 or 20%, heaven forbid, we could still, in 10 years, we could still predict or define the amount of premium dollars that the state would be subsidizing that individual. And that's why we call that a defined dollar approach.
Oh, okay. And following that, I just had a question on the post-Medicare eligibility. If Medicare melts down and the rates increase significantly for the their contribution rates or their payment rates decrease, are we, if with the plan as suggested, looking at a defined benefit unfettered above that in Medicare, post-Medicare eligibility?
Yeah, I think maybe we could examine the extreme scenario in the case that Medicare failed and there was no benefits provided by Medicare. I think that would be an extreme scenario. In that case, yes, the health costs would increase substantially because the system would then be responsible for providing the medical benefits that Medicare had previously paid for. And so there, that scenario, yes, that is the case that there would be additional cost to the system, or there would be, as you said, probably an unfunded liability would be generated from that scenario.
Okay, thanks. And Melanie, I believe you yes. need to go make another presentation.
I do. I apologize to all of the members. And Brad,
Mm-hmm.
Could you continue on with the presentation for the members, and then after the presentation, the members would like to go through your comments, and then Kathy has comments from the division as well. And again, my apologies.
Not a problem at all. That won't be a problem.
And Brad, do you have the House State Affairs presentation packet there that we're on slide 7 now?
Yes, I have the presentation. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much. Go ahead.
Okay. I think we'll kind of on slide 7 is a continuation of that second component of the medical program from normal retirement to Medicare eligibility. And what that slide is saying that the first point is a clarification that says when these individuals do become Medicare eligibility, the component changes and goes from that defined dollar to a defined benefit approach. The second point and the third point talk about dependent coverage, and it's important to note here that we have gone down a contribution path that says if a retiree has two individuals covered, say themselves and a spouse, then they will be paying contributions for two individuals, versus if the retiree is only covering themselves, they should only be responsible for a single contribution amount. The second point says that for spouses who are also in a pre-Medicare status, they're going to be eligible for that same defined dollar subsidy as the retiree is. And so they will have their contribution based on the same years of service or service duration that the retiree does. For spouses that are Medicare eligible, that are a little bit older than the retiree, they're going to be eligible for that Medicare level of benefits, or that Medicare eligible component, that third component. And as we'll see, that has a contribution percentage associated with it that varies by the length of service of the retiree.
Anyone have any questions on that? Okay. Go ahead, Brad.
Bye. Okay. And so moving on to slide 8, this is a numerical depiction of kind of how the defined dollar approach would work, in a sense. And so here what we're going to do is we're going to apply a percentage to a predetermined subsidy base to arrive at a subsidy amount. The current subsidy base that we have right now, we were proposing to be set at $5,962. And this is equivalent to the current fiscal year 2004 pre-Medicare projected claims cost. So the current base we decided to set equal to the claims cost as a starting point. The subsidy percentages would go from 30% up to 90%, varying on a retiree's years of service, going from 10 years of service up to 30 years of service. And we'll use an example of a retiree with 10 years of service. They would receive, towards their health cost, they would receive 30% of that subsidy base. So in other words, they would receive 30% of approximately $6,000. They would then be responsible for the remaining portion of the premium cost. So in this case, in the first year, they would be responsible for 70% of that claims cost. I think it's also important to note that the subsidy base of $5,962 will grow only at 5%. So that will not grow as actual claims costs grow. So if claims costs are going to grow at 10 or 15% and the subsidy base only grows at 5%, the retirees will be responsible for a larger and larger portion of their health care expenses at that point.
Like a ping pong ball.
And the last point here states that the member contributions will then be determined by subtracting the annual subsidy amount, which is the percent times the base, from the annual claims cost for a particular year.
Okay, Brad, a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
One is, we've got this set out in these groupings, 10 to 14, 15 to 19. And basically what we're talking about is 3% per year up to a maximum of 90%.
Mm-hmm.
I get somewhat concerned when we do these groupings because we get people making decisions of leaving the system because they're going to have to wait another 4 years before they can gain any more medical coverage, or people that are wanting to get out of their job but they're having to stay in for three more years because of this.
Kind of to hit that next bracket, so to speak.
Is there, what is the, was it discussed, and is there any downside to doing as we've done in 238 and saying at 10 years you're 30% and then it escalates 3% a year up to a maximum of 30 years at 90%?
So we I would say there are two considerations to think about in going to an approach like that. And first, let me clarify by saying I think that's a perfectly valid approach, and we have seen that approach with other clients that we work with in retiree medical. The first consideration is an administrative consideration. Certainly the more detail and the more, I don't know if you want to call it brackets or bands that you insert, will make that a little bit more administratively challenging. That is one consideration. The second consideration is that As you add a 3% subsidy for somebody with 11 years and add another 3 for someone with 12 years, you are increasing the overall subsidy that's provided to retirees in the system. And I think that's probably not a huge impact, but it will increase the cost somewhat from the numbers that we've presented here today and the numbers that were looked at in the redesign project.
Okay, thank you. And I think we've got a request in to look at those numbers and see what that cost differential would be. But we just wanted to get that discussed today.
But yeah, I you know, those two items said, I don't think there is anything that would stop or hinder you from going to an approach of 3% per year of service.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone else have any questions at this point? Okay, go ahead.
Okay. We'll move on to the next slide. And this is where we move into the third component of the medical benefit, and that is for Medicare eligibility, or after Medicare eligibility. This component is going to be a defined health benefit, very similar to the current program that retirees are under. The main difference is that retirees who were previously eligible for 100% subsidy will now have to pay some portion of that premium cost. Contributions will be on a per covered person basis, again, as we mentioned earlier, so that an individual who's covering two members or two participants will pay twice as much as someone who is covering only a single participant. Again, we have the dependent coverage issues, where we have a pre-Medicare dependent spouse will be eligible to receive a defined dollar subsidy with the percentage based on the retiree's length of service. And spouses who are Medicare eligible in the same category will be eligible to receive essentially the same benefit, the same defined health benefit as the retiree and pay that same contribution amount. And so that's the dependent issue there is to recognize the fact that if there is a pre-Medicare spouse, they're going to have a lot higher claims costs than that Medicare eligible retiree, and they will receive benefits under the second component or the defined dollar component until they reach Medicare eligibility age.
And under the after Medicare eligibility, there's no 5% escalator that's gone away, is there?
Right. We can talk about that a little bit. What, in fact, Let's go ahead and move to the next slide, which would be slide 10, where we talk about contributions, and we'll be able to outline the contribution methodology for this portion of the program. And so what we have here is we have retirees that will be contributing a percentage of the premium cost based on their length of service. Again, we have very similar years of service bands with individuals with 10 to 14 years of service contributing 30% of their claims cost and individuals with 30 or more years of service contributing only 10% of their claims cost. We note that the what we would call a contribution base on an annual basis for fiscal year 2004 would be $2,667. I think we can also note, and to me it's very striking, that even though that these individuals are on average quite a few years older than those individuals in the pre-Medicare group, their claims costs are still well under half of that pre-Medicare group.
And that's because Medicare picks up the primary health care.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And would exactly you define PMPY again?
That is per member per year. Okay. And we try and use the member distinction here is a per covered person might be a more appropriate way to think about that.
Okay, so this is participants, not necessarily members.
Exactly, yeah, and there's always, no matter what terminology you use, there's always a little bit of confusion in there. So maybe to think about this is again reiterating the fact that we want each individual that's covered under the program to be paying a contribution amount. And we do not want to penalize those individuals who are only covering themselves to be subsidizing those individuals who cover multiple dependents. And so here we have, while we have not eliminated the trend risk and volatility as we have with the second component or the defined dollar component, retirees will still be sharing in that trend component to the amount of the percentage that they're paying. So an individual with 10 to 14 years of service will be absorbing essentially 30% of that trend risk. So in here we meet the objective of the redesign of sharing that trend risk somewhat with those retirees. Here it was also felt that due to the lower claim volume, as Melanie mentioned, about 25%, it was desired to give retirees a larger benefit in this category and to maybe offer a little bit more subsidy in the Medicare eligible stages of retirement.
I guess, would you discuss the possibility of the 5% escalator in this category as well, or can that be applied here?
That could be applied. The thinking here was that they actually wanted to provide additional subsidy to those Medicare eligible individuals. The thought being that the second component, going from normal retirement to Medicare eligibility, was going to kind of provide a bridge into an area that if individual retires before Medicare eligibility, it's often very difficult for them to find coverage. And that was the access issue that Melanie was referring to. And if they do find coverage, it's often very expensive. So the individuals here have an opportunity, no matter when they retire, to have guaranteed access to that health coverage with no penalty for their own particular health status, as they would if they went out and bought insurance on an individual basis. And so the second component was designed to provide more of a bridge that if an individual chose to retire before their Medicare eligibility, we would offer them access and offer them some subsidy, but not a particularly large subsidy. The feeling for the Medicare eligible individuals was that there was a desire to provide an additional benefit or to provide additional levels of subsidy there and not tie that to a fixed dollar approach. As we mentioned earlier, the fixed dollar approach as the years increase, or as you project out, retirees will be covering a larger and larger percentage of the premium cost due to the fact that the premium cost is growing at a larger rate, which would be the trend rate at maybe 10 to 12 to potentially 15%, versus that subsidy base, which was only growing at 5%. And so that was the thought of the tier committee. We did run some scenarios where we did a fixed dollar approach for Medicare eligible individuals. And the final recommendation of the tier committee, their decision was to merge the two approaches, merge a defined benefit and a defined dollar approach.
So, Brad, I guess the question is, if you did a 5% escalator in this, did that, under Medicare eligibility, did you find that being, did you estimate that that would actually limit the amount that would be paid by the system, or was within the Medicare eligible, after Medicare eligibility, that the 5% wouldn't be reached?
No, it would be reached, and yes, it did result in an elimination of dollars paid by the system.
And
another aspect of that, there was a feeling that the medical component was being cut so much, and the cost of that program was being reduced substantially with just the defined dollar in the pre-Medicare phase or component, that there was not a desire to reduce it further to such an extent. I think they already had reduced it by, as we'll see in probably the next couple slides here, a few up, I think it was already reduced by probably over half.
Okay, if Melanie doesn't have those developmental materials, maybe we can get you to send them to us.
I've got.
Yeah.
Oh, you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Melanie's back, joined us again, and she says she has those, so we'll get those from her. Thank you.
Yeah, and if not, Brad, I'll talk to you after the presentation.
Absolutely. Okay. Melanie, would you like me to continue?
That would be great.
Okay. We're on slide 10. I guess I would ask if there are any further questions on slide 10.
Doesn't appear to be, so.
Okay. We will move on to slide 11. And as Melanie had mentioned earlier, one of the large changes that we made to the plan design was in the cost share or coordination of benefits approach for Medicare eligible individuals. As this slide shows, there are three widely accepted methods of coordination of benefits. And essentially, coordination of benefits, let me give just a slight bit of background. Coordination of benefits is kind of the process of integrating a plan's benefit package with the benefits that Medicare will pay. And the process is used to determine how much the plan sponsor and the plan participants are going to pay and how much will be paid by Medicare. All of these three methods are designed to ensure that at no point is more than 100% of the claims cost paid. And so we'll kind of talk about the three approaches just a little bit. The system currently operates under the traditional approach. And as the slide indicates, that under this approach, the plan calculates what it would have paid as the sole provider, and then determines what Medicare would have paid, and they will pay up to 100% of the benefit cost, or what they would have paid in the absence of Medicare, towards that claims cost. And we can kind of just go through the example real quick here. Say we have a plan design of $100 deductible and 80% coinsurance. If we have a total expense of $1,100, Of that, we're using an example that Medicare will pay $600 of that. In this approach, the plan would have taken off $100 deductible, which would have left $1,000, and then they would have paid 80% of that remaining portion, which would have been $800. So the plan, in a sense, would have paid, in the absence of Medicare, would have paid $800 towards that $1,100 cost. Since Medicare is paying for $600, that leaves $500 to be paid for. Since the plan would have originally paid up to $800, they will cover the entire $500 remaining portion of the cost not borne by Medicare. And so we see in this instance that the retiree has no cost sharing associated with that claim. And early on in the tier design process, this was brought up as a concern by the subcommittee, where Medicare-eligible individuals were being very isolated from the claims cost or the cost of the services that they were receiving. There were some examples even cited where a check might actually come back to them through some savings approaches and various other mechanisms. So one of the primary approaches was to ensure that there was some cost sharing involved and that the cost sharing would be fairly consistent for when these individuals were in the pre-Medicare state to when they became Medicare eligible. So suddenly when they are 64 being subject to a $200 deductible and then when they're 65 still being subject to that same $200 deductible. So having a consistency of that cost sharing across pre-Medicare and Medicare-eligible status. The subcommittee chose to look at the third approach that we have here, which is maintenance of benefits. And in this instance, the plan calculates the payment as if there were no Medicare coverage, applying the deductible and the coinsurance and so on, other plan limits and cost-sharing elements, and then pays the remaining amount over and above what Medicare would pay. And we can kind of walk through the example. In that $1,100 claim, we assume that the retiree will pay $100 of the deductible and will leave a remaining $1,000 balance. The coinsurance element at 80% will leave a balance of $800 that the plan would cover. This is as we discussed a little bit earlier. And then Medicare will pay $600 of that. So of that $800 the plan would have originally covered, Medicare will now pay $600 of that, and it leaves $200 to be borne by the system. So in this case, the retiree will have the entire cost-sharing amount that they would have had in the absence of Medicare, and that is the $100 deductible and the $200 coinsurance cost for a total of $300. Medicare will pay their same $600, and the plan will now cover a $200 remaining portion.
Okay. Does everyone follow that? Representative Grunberg.
This looks like it's fantastically more expensive for the retiree than what we've had before, isn't it?
My dates and timing may be a little bit different, but I believe this was the same cost share design that was in place prior to, and Melanie might be able to help me out, prior to 2000 or 2001. Is that correct, Melanie?
Are you talking about the traditional plan, or I'm sorry, Brad? Where?
I think that the system went from a maintenance of benefits to a traditional approach just as, 3, 4, 5 years ago.
Okay, I'm getting a confirmation from Kathy Lee, who was there during that time period, so the answer mm-hmm. would be yes.
Okay, so the system has been under this approach in the past. I don't have the background on why it was changed, but I think you can see that the impact is going from in a pre-Medicare status where that individual would have paid $300, and so they're used to that cost-sharing element in their plan design, to when they hit a Medicare-eligible status, all of a sudden their cost-sharing is eliminated, and it really removes them from feeling the pain of their health care costs. And again, it was decided or desired that they would experience some element of cost sharing in the plan.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Lawson, I don't know if you were aware, but these people were getting longevity bonuses and stuff before.
And no, I was not aware of that.
Yeah, it was quite different before.
Mm-hmm.
And they've just been hit with the loss of their longevity bonus and the rising cost of a living. And so they will wind up paying, and I guess maybe I should ask Kathy, if you're the person who knows, all these people at the time they were paying this were getting longevity bonuses, were they not, or at least some of them were, I guess not all of them.
Some of them, oh.
I think another important element to consider is that there is an out-of-pocket maximum for these charges, so these would not be indefinite, you know, charges that would be incurred. For example, on that 80% coinsurance, if they had a catastrophic claim in the thousands and thousands of dollars, they would be limited under the plan design, and I'm going to flip back here a couple slides. They would be limited to a total out-of-pocket expense of $2,500.
What slide are you on?
And that would be on slide, I believe it is slide 3. So there is an element of that upfront cost sharing, but there are protections built in for what we would say a total dollar maximum out of pocket that the retiree would be subject to.
I'm sorry, where were we?
We're on slide 3, where it's a maximum out of pocket is $2,500.
And that would be the third line, third item down.
I see.
Like a normal major medical is 80-20, but after you have a certain amount of out-of-pocket expenses, then it goes to 100% coverage by the plan.
Right. And again, to kind of restate, there was a desire to keep that cost sharing consistent from when those retirees were in a pre-Medicare status to when they went to a Medicare status. So it's not a cost that they would be. It's not an additional cost that would arise for them when they became Medicare eligible. It would just be the same cost that they would be used to in their pre-Medicare plan.
I'd like to focus back, Mr. Chair, on the statement that, quote, they were used to this several years ago. At the time that this plan was in effect, and ma'am, your last name is?
Lee.
Ms. Lee, I'm kind of focusing on that for a second, if I could, since she knows. How many years ago was that?
For the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the Division of Retirement Benefits Retirement Manager. Through the Chair, Representative Gruenberg, I believe it was around in 2000 that we made the change from the governmental carve-out or the maintenance of benefits to the traditional method. One of the reasons that we made the change, of course, was because the funds appeared to be well-funded at that time, and our retirees were notifying both the division and the boards that with increasing Medicare costs, because they are required to enroll in Medicare Part B, they weren't getting anything for their Medicare premium. They were paying the same out-of-pocket and same deductibles that they were before they went through Medicare, and that was one of the reasons for the change to the traditional plan.
I see. Now, did the loss of the longevity bonus then affect these folks? How would if we went to this plan now, how would that negatively affect these people vis-a-vis back then when they still had their longevity bonus?
Through the Chair, Representative Gruenberg, some of our members were receiving a longevity bonus, and they have since obviously not received it. So returning back to this method would increase their out-of-pocket share up to the $2,500 out-of-pocket limit.
Ms. Lee, do we know what proportion of the retirees were receiving or were not receiving longevity bonus, because, you know, although we might have some people that were receiving this, if it wasn't a function of the plan, and if half of the members were receiving that and half of them weren't, it's hard to design a plan around half of the members and say, oh, well, you know, you no longer receive a longevity bonus, so we're going to make this change for everybody. I mean, it, unless this was, you know, we have to make sure that we're talking apples and apples here.
And it looked like Ms. Milhorn was kind of whispering in your, do you want to confer amongst yourselves before you answer a question, please? Feel free.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, there are a portion of our members who do receive, who were receiving the longevity bonus, were not aware of how many those may be. However, it is important to note that there is still the health reimbursement arrangement portion of the health plan that would be paying deductibles and premiums as well.
Could you answer the chair's question?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, that was just on the proportion of, if we knew the proportion. We can get that later if you don't have it.
Yeah, we can get that later.
Yeah, I'd like
to. Yeah, because we'd like to have the real numbers instead of just guessing.
So, I guess my concern, from the point of view of the plan, this talk about proportion of this and proportion of that is fine, but from the point of view of the retiree, it's all the bottom line. You know what I'm saying.
Does anybody else have any questions on what that is? That's the 80-20 split and the normal medical reimbursement cost up to the dollar max. Okay, go ahead. Melanie, are you, or Brad, who's?
Brad's taking
Brad,
the lead.
Brad's okay. Taking us along. Thanks.
Okay, we can go move on to slide 12. And these are a chart of the normal cost rates by component for the entire retirement system under the alternative 2, which contained a defined contribution pension plan and the medical program that we've talked about previously. We start out with the medical normal cost rate for TERS of 3.75 and for PERS of 3.5. I thought it might be interesting to give a quick example on this particular line item. Prior to the program changes that we've discussed, those costs were previously a little bit over 9% and a little bit under 9%. So 9.07 and 8.68%. So there, you can see that there is already, even with the non-defined dollar benefit or the defined health benefit portion in the Medicare eligible component, there's still a significant savings to the system with this program.
Let's see. Would you go through the slide there, Melanie? And is that shown on the slide? There's 9%. I'm missing.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Chair Seaton. It is not in the presentation material. It is in the November 19th presentation material, and it's slide number 86, which I can provide to the members. That is the normal cost rate right now for PERS and TERS would be the 9.7 for PERS and the 8.68 for PERS.
So, and then if we move on, we can see that the defined contribution rate is 13.5%. for TERS and 11.5% for PERS. We have an HRA contribution of 1.5% for TERS and 1% for TERS. And this comes results in a gross normal cost rate of 18.75% for TERS and 16% for PERS. We have member contribution rates of 10% in TERS and 8% in PERS, which results in net normal cost rates of 8.75% for TERS and 8% for PERS.
Okay, and we, let's see. Oh, we're going to get into health reimbursement plan. So maybe we should save that percentage discussion to Lynn. Is that right, Melanie? the how this percentage or defined dollar amount and which it really is till then. I mean, we have this listed as a percentage HRA contribution rate as if it's for an employer and not a fixed dollar amount, which is, I believe, what it really is. And so do you want to wait and have that discussion a little bit later or now?
Yeah, I think we can have that discussion in the presentation with the HRA because I think it will clarify as we go along.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions on this slide? Now, this is alternative two from the tier proposal that was presented before. This is the defined contribution plan, and this is the same health care component, though, of either of the two alternatives. So this is what's been presented here, you know, is not strictly what we have, but in 238, but this was the tier committee proposal. So, go ahead, Melanie, or Brad.
Okay. So the next section will talk a little bit about health reimbursement accounts, and we can move on to slide 14. Important to give a little bit of background on the health reimbursement arrangements or accounts. This was something that was discussed and initiated later in the tiered redesign process, so they did not have an opportunity to be fleshed out and detailed and discussed in as much depth as some of the other components of the medical program. I believe this was introduced in the September meeting, or there was a desire indicated to explore this further. And for the November meeting, we gathered some educational information, some discovery information, and made some general projections of the health reimbursement account values under given scenarios. So this is some material from that presentation, some general overview material. An HRA is an arrangement that is solely employer paid. It reimburses employees for their medical expenses, and it provides reimbursements up to a maximum dollar amount for a defined coverage period. Unused funds can be carried forward from year to year. This is in contrast to a flexible spending account that we have been used to in the past. They're usually, but not required, to be associated with high-deductible health plans or consumer-directed health plans. They do include some aspects of flexible spending accounts, and the official IRS name is a health reimbursement arrangement, but they're also known as defined contribution health care plans. We talk a little, the next slide, moving on to slide 15, talks a little bit about funding. As we mentioned, funding is provided only via employer dollars. The employer has a lot of flexibility in setting their own limits and determining what amounts to fund at. Eligibility for these HRAs are current and former employees, including retirees, and all spouses and other dependents. COBRA participants can also be eligible for these, as well as dependents who can have their medical expenses reimbursed upon death of the retiree or employee.
And do you want to define for the committee COBRA, please?
Those would be individuals who have, for one reason or another, lost their coverage. It could be from a layoff. It could be in a situation where there would be a separation of a spouse and an employee. Could be from the death of the employee, a number of instances. And the COBRA regulation allows provision for those individuals to retain their health care coverage for up from 18 to 36 months, as long as they are, and I think they are required to pay, and the employers can charge them for up to 102% of the current active medical cost.
Okay, thank you.
And I think COBRA was the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act.
Yeah, that's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. In slide 16, we talk a little bit about the benefits of the HRAs. Their reimbursements for medical expenses, any expense as defined by the Internal Revenue Code, Section 213D. There are no IRS limits on reimbursements. The employees are responsible for substantiating their own expenses, so there would be no system obligation to substantiate expense reimbursements. They cannot be used for over-the-counter drugs, such as you would go into a retail store and purchase. And there can be no right to receive any type of cash benefit from the plan. Moving to slide 17, we talk a little bit about plan design. And in this case, I think the theme is flexibility. The plan sponsor can dictate the plan design completely, from contribution amounts to covered expenses and when those expenses are eligible to be reimbursed, as well as any termination provisions that are desired in the plan. In this case, those HRA accounts can vest, they can forfeit. It's very flexible from the plan sponsor's perspective. For tax treatment, there's a requirement. The requirements for exclusion from income tax are that they're funded solely by employer dollars, and correspondingly no employee contributions are permitted, and that they only reimburse qualified medical expenses. Another point to note is that they are subject to non-discrimination rules under the IRS code section 105H.
Okay, and can you explain to the committee what that non-discrimination rule, the implications of that are?
Yeah, I think they would be, let me preface by saying that that is not my personal area of expertise. When we do our analysis, we typically have in-house attorneys and experts that assist us with that. But that would be the case where individuals are not permitted. I think for example, in a high salaried individual would not be permitted to receive a substantially larger contribution than a lower salaried individual in this case. And there are a number of other non-discrimination rules and elements to that I'm not prepared to discuss at this time.
Okay, and I think Melanie and I have discussed this a bit, but we want to get that discussion for the committee so that they
absolutely understand. Agreed.
So I'm not meaning to put you on the spot here. We'll put Melanie on the spot.
Not a problem at all.
Thank you, Brad.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone, before we go to Melanie about non-discrimination and how this HRA works as far as contribution rates and how we that works, that has any questions for Brad from Mercer? Okay, go ahead, Melanie.
Yeah. In my discussion with Representative Seaton, I needed to provide a little bit of background about the HRA and how the amounts were arrived at, because I think it is confusing if you were not there and worked through that process, and I'm not sure that the presentation material really lends itself to a clear understanding about the 1% portion, because the 1% portion that is the cost to the employer for a health reimbursement arrangement is really derived by looking at a system-wide average salary amount in order to make that computation, and that goes back to the non-discriminatory language to ensure that an individual who is less compensated as compared to an individual who would have a higher level of compensation would, under a health reimbursement arrangement, receive the same level of benefit. So the 1% portion, the cost to the employer, the projections were to look at a system-wide average of $35,000 and make a computation of a system-wide average salary in order to determine what that benefit amount is for all members.
And I think I will add one more comment in there. The other issue that we ran into by doing a percentage of an individual salary is that very closely links that contribution amount to that account to the employee's personal salary. And as we saw, for tax purposes, there can be no direct or indirect funding related to an employee's personal compensation. And so by doing a percentage of their salary, that implies a fairly clear indirect relationship to that compensation and may disqualify it for tax advantage treatment.
And for the committee's information, the problem becomes that, you know, we're looking at employees, and let's say we were talking about professors at the University of Alaska who would be a very high-paid group, and 1% of their salary would be quite significant, whereas we're talking about 1% of $35,000, which is $350. All of a sudden, that's only like a quarter of a percent for their deduction. But if you had an employer, and we don't have our chart down here, we'll have to get that back, that shows all the diversity of employees, that if you had an employer that was predominantly having school board people getting $100 a month, city council people getting $50 a month, those kind of employees, all of a sudden $350 a year is 60% of the gross salary just for the HRA. Mm-hmm. Now, not that we're saying that people should be qualified for this medical paying nothing in, but all of a sudden the complexity changes quite a bit between all of the PERS employees. TERS is basically one unit, and it's probably much more uniform than is PERS, but PERS is going to have a wide discrepancy of employees and wage bases. And so let's say if you were an employee that had an average wage of $17,000 in your unit, instead of paying 1% of their wages, that $350 is going to be 2% of their wages. And it was going to be not as a percentage system-wide, but as a direct dollar contribution to the system. Is that correct, Melanie? Am I explaining that well enough?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I think each year the intent was to determine an average salary for the system as a whole, and then to apply that 1 or 1.5% to that average salary, and thereby becoming a fixed dollar amount. So that's correct.
Yeah, but you won't see that fixed dollar amount in any of the materials, but we need to remember that, because it's going to affect different employees differently. And Melanie, I believe we talked about trying to alleviate some of that, because we have, how many employers are there in PERS?
There's approximately 155 PERS employers.
Okay, so if we were looking at the 155 PERS employers, and we took each one of those and made the calculation based on their wage base, then there wouldn't be discrimination within that employer, but we would get rid of this discrepancy between different employers based on a system-wide averages. Are we still thinking that would qualify and not get us under this non-discriminatory provision?
Chair Seaton, we did have that conversation. We asked Brad to go back and look at that and make a determination if that would create a discrimination kind of issue for us. I'm not confident right now, when you look at the employer as a whole for PERS, that maybe by carving out individual employers, on the face of it, it looks like that might tailor the benefits and the costs commensurate with that on an individual employer basis. But because we look at the system as a whole, and we have to manage the system as a whole, I'd like to have that question asked and answered definitively to make a determination, because one could argue that by treating one employer within the whole system differently for benefit calculation purposes as another, which we don't have right now, may cause a problem. So while I recognize what you're, there's merit to your wanting to look at it because there are wide differences, I believe. But I think that we need to ask the experts to get some confidence that it's not problematic. It would add an additional administrative cost, but that's a separate matter. I think the overarching issue would be, would it create a discriminatory problem for the plan?
Right, and that's why we've asked the question. We don't have to have it answered today. We just have to know that we do have, every time you look at these charts, and there was a $500 limit in there, and it appeared that that $500 limit was, well, nobody would, at 1% of their salary, would, you were limited at $500, but that's not what that means. That means that $500 is growth over time. If the average salary gets up to $60,000, it would still be limited at $500 in the future, would be the maximum amount you could get. I believe that's, I mean, it's quite confusing as to trying to figure out from the limited data that we have what that means, but is that a fair representation of what that meant?
Yeah, Chair Seaton, I believe that that's accurate. There's also some additional information. When we assembled this presentation material, we didn't go into the same level of detail as in the November 19th presentation, because it would go on. You can spend an inordinate amount of time talking about the medical component alone. So we tried to really key off of some slides that would give a broad brush and then delve into the details as the members chose to look at those features a little bit more,
sure,
more comprehensively. But I think it would be beneficial, Brad, if maybe you provide the members with kind of the projected benefit amounts that would be available to members who retired from the system under the HRA, because I think that this feature is a very key feature. It provides a very powerful vehicle for members to start thinking about health care costs for themselves personally, individually, planning for that in the future. I think we all recognize that health care costs are a national issue, and this is one vehicle that is thought to be very powerful for the individual on a tax-deferred basis to plan for those expenditures in the future and then to make some corresponding decisions about that, because I think right now we have a system where our medical plan right now as a retiree doesn't cause you to have to think about your medical expenses because they are just simply provided for. And by providing a vehicle that accumulates assets, it triggers you to be cognizant of those assets and make some key decisions based on that. You could decide to have your medical procedure done in Juneau, or you could choose to do some research and find out that the costs were far better for you personally and the system at the same time if you had that procedure done in Anchorage. And so this is that type of vehicle that looks at consumer-driven health care for the future, and it also, because of the new plan design, because it's asking members to share in those costs, recognizing that 40% of the accrued liabilities for our underfunded status is medical costs for PERS, 28 for TERS, this particular medical plan goes a long way toward addressing medical costs in the future and still provides a very solid benefit to the members.
And that's, of course, we got to remember that while we're constructing this, the primary purpose is to have a benefit that will attract and retain employees. And for the employer to be able to attract and retain good employees, so
they don't get broken process.
The one thing we are spending a lot of time on this healthcare, but I think that, you know, as Melody just pointed out, you know, we're talking about a huge portion of the unfunded liability comes from the healthcare system that we currently have, which means that of all the parts that we need to fix, probably the healthcare is one of the ones that we're going to have to fix the quickest. And so I really want to, you know, we really appreciate the presentation. A couple of other things. One is that, you know, my experience in private healthcare plans is that the doubling the deductible almost halves the premium. And I'm wondering how we are having this really low deductible. Wouldn't we be better to have a slightly higher deductible, and even if we had to increase the amount of the healthcare reimbursement plan, wouldn't we save tremendously over time if our base contribution into the premium amount would be less?
Yeah, and I think Brad, first of all, his background, he's a subject matter expert in the medical area. So as an actuary, that's an area that he specializes in exclusively. And he can really speak to other private plans a little bit better than I can, except to say that in benchmarking with some of the other pension systems that were looked at, including two employers in the state of Alaska, it appears that that deductible kind of aligns itself when you compare across those various different benchmarks. But Brad, I think you can speak to the component that Chair Seaton's asked about in just the change of the medical design to increase the deductible portion and how that correlates to the premium cost reduction.
Okay, certainly.
And Brad, before you go on, you know, I'm not meaning to say that we want to reduce a benefit here.
Sure.
What I'm saying is, can we save a whole lot in the system by having a higher deductible but then a higher contribution into the healthcare reimbursement account, which would offset for individual employees that amount? It seems like, and if you could address, you know, that's the balance that I'm trying to look at here.
Certainly. Yeah, I think when we went through our design process and phase, we arrived at the $250. There were a couple elements that went into that. One was that a few years ago, that was the benchmark. That was the average deductible level for plans of this type, and there was a desire to get to an average, something that wasn't necessarily very super aggressive, but something that was not lagging behind either for cost sharing. It was felt that the deductible levels, we had some proposals of $500 and $350, and during the redesign process, those levels were just felt to be too high and not receptive to them. So I think that there's two elements. One, the deductible definitely can get you some mileage, but sometimes you have to increase it more than you might intuitively expect to get really substantial savings. There's a lot of very high expenses that are out in the what we call the tails, the catastrophic claims and the very expensive portions of that. The other element with deductible, in particular in the state of Alaska's case, is the inability to increase it in future years. What a lot of plan sponsors that we've worked with will do is every couple years they will increase the deductible by $50 or, you know, occasionally $100. And that's kind of to keep pace with inflation. When you have a constant deductible but you have a growing health care cost, the value of that constant deductible tends to erode over time. And so if we looked back 10 years ago or 15 years ago, a $200 or $250 deductible would mean a lot more back then than it does today. And so if we look forward into 10 years, in reality, a $250 deductible will not necessarily mean the same that it does today. I think there's a couple things around that, and there's one is just the very big challenge of the non-diminution of the benefits, the protected status of the benefits, is probably the largest one that prevents us from implementing a strategy like that. So where you can take that cost share and change it over time as your costs change. And so when faced with that kind of a constraint, the next best place to go in and try and establish a cost sharing is by a percent of premium. And by establishing a constant percent of premium contribution to try and get your cost savings, you're going to, as your costs continue to grow, so will your contributions at that same point. So we kind of felt that it was better to focus on the contribution aspect of it, because that was a percentage of the cost and could grow with time, than to focus on the fixed cost share elements, such as the deductible, that were viewed as remaining static over the course of the tier.
I guess what maybe we would like to do is get Aetna or you, somebody, mm-hmm. to give us a little spreadsheet on that, and also we'd like to address the consideration of, you know, if we can have escalating 5% premium payments, why can't, I mean, we're building in a new tier, so on these, so we're not talking about diminishing past accrued benefits. So is there any reason why we can't build in whatever that deductible is and have it change at a fixed 5% rate?
Boy, I think that would be outstanding. We did explore that a little bit, and I think the board's attorney was of the opinion that was, had a word, dangerous ground, or it was uncertain ground, and he felt that there would be grounds for challenge based on past case history for that.
Well, I guess I'm just having a problem figuring out how we can say that we're going to have premium escalating at 5% and say that that's unchallenged, not going to be subject to the same challenge as the deductible escalating at a maximum of 5%. I mean, it seems that we have the same exact thing. We're building a new tier. If everybody knows the benefit when they come in, and the benefit is this escalating at 5%, that's, you know, there's no question of changing the deal, because they know the deal when they come in. Anyway, we do have to break here. I appreciate it. If you could work with Melanie and figure out who can get that answer back to us.
Certainly.
We didn't get as far as we wanted to. We've got our three-page rewrite of the medical from my staff, and some two pages of comments from Melanie on, or the division on those. And so we would like to check that. Also, I would like to make some announcements. Thanks, Melanie. 9:30 a.m. ASPIB, that's Alaska State Pension Investment Board, will be in my office. And that's
tomorrow?
Tomorrow, so that any of the members that want to meet there. And also 3:30 to 4:30, there'll be an informal work group in House State Affairs here. That's on Wednesday with ASPIB. We're talking about major restructuring on the boards, including ASPIB. So I hope members will be able to attend. Also, I would like to let everybody in the committee and everyone else know that if you have any amendments that you wish to talk about on the 87, the seatbelt bill, would you meet with Representative Elkins and Representative Grunberg today so that we can get those finalized and ready to go? Hopefully we can get that before us on Thursday. And so I want to let everybody know that we'll probably have 87 as a bill previously heard on Thursday, if we can get those amendments done. So, you know, if you can, the members can meet with, meet together to finalize those, that would be great. And without anything else, we will be adjourned, and it's 10 o'clock.